Here's something that J.K. Rowling, Mark Twain, Maya Angelou, and Philip Pullman have in common. They've all written some of the books that community members try most often to remove from public libraries and schools. That's according to the American Library Association, which this week marks its annual Banned Books Week. One novel that survived early censorship to become a classic is John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. NPR's Lynn Neary has the story.
People give a lot of reasons for wanting to ban books, says Judith Krug of the American Library Association. Politics, religion, sex, even witchcraft. But in the end, Krug says, there's really only one thing that would-be censors want to stop.
They're not afraid of the book, they're afraid of the ideas. And the thing that's so interesting is that the materials that are challenged and banned are the books that say something about the human condition. And I can't think of a better example of that than The Grapes of Wrath.
When The Grapes of Wrath was published in 1939, it was banned or burned in a number of cities. But nowhere was opposition to the book so close to the bone as in Kern County, California, where John Steinbeck's fictional Joad family landed after their escape from the Dust Bowl. Rick Wartzman is the author of a new book, Obscene in the Extreme, which is the story of the banning of The Grapes of Wrath in Kern County.
It's a window into the class politics of the 30s, this deep divide between far left and far right.
Steinbeck's novel was firmly rooted in real events. 3 years before the book was published, President Franklin Roosevelt gave this speech after touring 9 states that had been devastated by drought.
No cracked earth, no blistering sun, no burning wind, no grasshoppers are a permanent match for the indomitable American farmers and stockmen and their wives and children who have carried on through desperate days and inspire us with their self-reliance, their tenacity, and their courage.
But even FDR's optimism could not hold back the tide of humanity that poured out of the Dust Bowl states, desperate for work. This young migrant story, recorded for the Library of Congress, was typical of those who made their way west.
Then we come on over in California in 38, and at that time came quite a flood here in California.
Many of the hundreds of thousands of people who came to California looking for work landed in Kern County. Penniless and homeless, they took jobs picking crops when they could. It was their story that John Steinbeck fictionalized in The Grapes of Wrath. The book was an instant bestseller. But Rick Wartzman says some people from Kern County resented the way they were depicted in the novel.
The powers that be thought they were really doing right by these people in a lot of ways. They had a pretty good public health care system, for instance, and they thought that Steinbeck really portrayed them unfairly. One of the members of the Board of Supervisors called The Grapes of Wrath a libel and a lie.
In August 1939, by a vote of 4-1, the Kern County Board of Supervisors approved a resolution banning The Grapes of Wrath from county libraries and schools. Wartzman says one powerful local player who pushed the ban was Bill Camp, head of the local Associated Farmers, a group of big landowners who were avid opponents of organized labor.
And that's what they were really afraid of. They really did not want to be unionized. They didn't want their fields to be organized in any way.
And they did have influence with the county supervisors.
Oh, absolutely. Bill Camp was an extremely influential guy in Kern County. And these were really rough guys. I mean, if you go back and look at the record through the 30s, they had tremendous political influence in Sacramento. They knew how to work a bill, but they also knew how to work with tire irons and pick handles and bricks, and things could get really ugly and violent.
There was no mistaking which side The Grapes of Wrath was on. This scene from the film version of the book vividly illustrates the hostility between the workers and the wealthy farmers who hired them and also controlled the local police.
I asked to see his license. He ain't allowed by law to contract men without a license.
Hey, Joe. Agitator. Ever see this guy before?
Seems like I have. Seems like I seen him hanging around a used car lot that was busted into. Yep, that's the fella. Get in this car.
Got nothing on him.
Open your trap again and you'll go too.
In Kern County, Bill Camp was convinced that many of the migrants themselves were offended by The Grapes of Wrath. So Camp recruited one of his workers, Clell Pruitt, to burn the book. Pruitt never read the novel, but heard a radio program about it, which made him angry. So he readily agreed to take part in what Wartzman describes as a photo op.
There's a picture of Bill Camp kind of presiding over this book burning as Clell Pruitt drops a copy of The Grapes of Wrath into a pail with the flames shooting out of it. This is not a big, you know, Nazi-style public square, hundreds of books being burned. But the significance is that Clell Pruitt, not one of the big growers, actually burned the book.
While Camp was working to publicize the events in Kern County, the local librarian, Gretchen Neef, was working quietly to get the ban overturned. At the risk of losing her job, Neef stood up to the county supervisors. Her letter asking them to reverse their decision is a remarkable and eloquent argument against all efforts to ban books. Here, Wortsman reads an excerpt.
If that book is banned today, what will be banned tomorrow? And what group will want a book banned the day after that? It's such a vicious and dangerous thing to begin, and may in the end lead to exactly the same thing we see in Europe today. Besides, banning books is so utterly hopeless and futile. Ideas don't die because a book is forbidden reading.
Gretchen Neef's argument didn't work. The supervisors upheld the ban, and it remained in effect for a year and a half. But, says Judith Krug, the censorship of The Grapes of Wrath was a key event in the creation of the Library Bill of Rights.
It says, in effect, that as American citizens, we have the right to access whatever information we wish without anyone looking over our shoulders, that we have the right to utilize this information once we have acquired it.
Most of the people involved in the banning of The Grapes of Wrath are no longer alive, but Rick Wortsman did track down Clell Pruitt, who has since died. Pruitt finally read the book at Wortsman's behest and afterwards told Wortsman he had no regrets about burning it. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And you can read an excerpt from Rick Wortsman's book, Obscene in the Extreme, and see the infamous photo of Clell Pruitt setting fire to The Grapes of Wrath on our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Renee Montaigne is back with us tomorrow. I'm Steve Inskeep.
If you happen to be traveling to North Dakota, the official tourist guides might send you to the Toy Farmer Museum or the Emter Family Music Theater. But wouldn't you really rather go ditch skiing?
Ditch skiing involved a rope tied to the rear fender of the family station wagon.
Novelist Louise Erdrich on growing up in North Dakota.
A child on a pair of giant wooden skis would hold the end of the rope, give her father the thumbs up, and brace herself as he started the car. Towed along at blinding speeds of 6 to 12 miles an hour while gulping snert, half snow, half dirt, was a matchless winter experience.
That's from Louise Erdrich's essay in the compilation called State by State, A Panoramic Portrait of America. The new book brings together writers like Jonathan Franzen, Dave Eggers, and my colleague Jackie Lydon. Each author writes a personal essay about one of the 50 states. State by State was inspired by the American Guide series of the 1930s. The Works Progress Administration sent authors on the road during the Great Depression to create a series of travel guides.
Saul Bellow, Nelson Algren,
Richard Wright,
Neil Hurston.
That's Sean Wilsey and Matt Weiland, the book's editors.
Ralph Ellison.
Jim Thompson.
John Cheever, who complained about it and actually didn't think that it was a very worthwhile endeavor. But they all were young writers in this program. And the books they produced reflect their literary talent and portray the country in all its variety and texture. And we wanted to do a book that paid homage to that, but yet was personal because their voices also tended to be flattened because they had to write for a book that had to be a guide literally to how to drive around a state and the history of the state. And we wanted, you know, the writers to be able to express themselves and do what they do best, which is to show what they have at stake in their writing.
And to create, instead of a literal guidebook, a kind of guidebook to the soul of each state.
I learned a lot about the country working on the book. This is Sean, by the way. Alexander Payne, who wrote about Nebraska, writes this piece that I think a lot of us would think of Nebraska and think of it as almost the ur-bland state right in the center. And he talks about how even the WPA guide describes Nebraska as this state that's always driven through and that nobody stops in.
One of the square states.
Yeah, that's right. It's like one of the perfect, exactly. It's just been drawn by a draftsman. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how so many people that he knows, including himself, he's moved back there part-time, returned to Omaha after going away, and he quotes a friend of his who says that he did it to be, quote, woven more deeply into the fabric of life.
Let's listen to a little bit of Alexander Payne.
Unlike Americans on the coasts who flaunt even what they don't have, Nebraskans would never wish to appear, bend over backwards not to appear, better than anyone else, or to possess more than what they seemingly need. The state motto is equality before the law, but one could add equality before others. People are surprised to learn that Warren Buffett still lives in the same middle-class house he bought in 1958 for $31,500. But to us, it's perfectly normal, textbook Nebraska. My parents bought our house two blocks away in 1956. They still live there, too.
So do all the writers write about where they're from?
No, we felt it was important that it not simply be a kind of beauty pageant where all the writers write about their own state and it be a kind of celebration of each state that way. So we sent some writers to places they'd never been before, because I think a great writer, you know, with fresh eyes and a deadline can tell us things about a place that even natives can't. So, for example, the wonderful Mexican-American writer Dagoberto Gilb, who lives in Texas, we sent him to Iowa, where, of course, there are many Mexican migrant workers working in the cornfields. And Dagoberto went up and spent some time working with them and seeing what their lives are like. I think it's one of the most moving parts of the book.
Let's listen to some of that one.
This is about the tortilla. This is about corn grown in Iowa. This is about the people who are in the campos of Iowa picking the vegetables and walking the cornfields. Those people are Mexican people. They're of the culture where hand-ground masa was first patted into tortillas, and because of that, it is said that the physical body of any Mexicano is at least half corn. They are from the civilization that worshipped the corn plant as a god. In some regions, such as what became known as Guatemala, the God, the image of God.
This is Matt again. I think, of course, corn is a huge subject these days, but when do we ever hear enough about, you know, the young Mexicans who are working in those cornfields and how their work goes and what they think of their new lives in America? That goes throughout the book. There are a lot of immigrant stories. This is a book with tales about Bosnians in Missouri, Chinese in Georgia, Bangladeshi in Rhode Island, Koreans in Indiana.
Ghanaians in Michigan.
That's right.
And as Matt points out about Dagoberto, he's a Mexican-American writer, but he's just an incredible observer, and he's able to talk to people.
One of the things that I just love about this book, and my editor and I sat around reading statistics out of the back of the book.
Yeah.
I'm looking at them now. You've got roller coasters per capita. Along with the violent crime rate, breastfeeding rate.
We had a lot of fun making that appendix. One of the things that came out of it is that, you know, again, a fundamental point of the book is that states vary, and they vary a lot. We may all think that places are becoming more and more the same, and that's true as you know, if you stay on the interstates and you only go to big box superstores and so on. But what was remarkable about those statistics is you can put them in order, and it's amazing to see quite the disparity from high to low.
And the portraits that are drawn by those statistics are astounding to me. We try to give a variety of states the number one slot, so we really were looking for different tables that would do that. New Hampshire, you know, roller coasters. Crazily enough, Wisconsin, number one, you might think dairy or something like that, but it's alcohol consumption.
Right. My own state of Minnesota, I'm proud to say, is number one in voter participation rate.
What's your favorite?
Oh, toothlessness for me.
Toothlessness always.
How can you not
out.
Love toothlessness? It's just
the poor West Virginians.
The people even kept track, and then it's West Virginia. It's interesting when cliches end up being true, and I think every writer in the book kind of explores how cliches can be very revealing. And of course, you want to look deeper than the cliches, but they exist for a reason.
On a more serious note, you know, it does seem like to those of us who travel a little bit that everywhere you go, there's a Walmart, a Target, an Exxon station, a Sally Beauty Supply, a Best Buy, and a PetSmart. And it just seems like...
I see where you're shopping.
It seems like, you know, the culture of America has become homogenized.
I think that's true to some extent, but it's only as true as we allow it to be. Local difference and variety in local culture persists in the face of enormous pressure, and that if we would only see it and recognize it and champion it, it would have a chance of winning out.
Matt Weiland and Sean Wilsey, they're the editors of the book State by State, A Panoramic Portrait of America.
I am Neda Ulibi, host of NPR's podcast Book Tour. This week, the author of the best-selling novel Prep reads from her new book, American Wife. It's about a fictional young schoolteacher who seems a lot like Laura Bush.
His arrogance was really rather extraordinary. It was amusing, and it was also irritating. I'm a registered Democrat, I said. That's something you might want to include in your dossier on me. And I have to say that you're remarkably confident for someone who's about to run against a 40-year incumbent. Rather than being insulted, Charlie appeared delighted. I always appreciate someone who's done her research, he said. You know who does seem like ideal wife material? He pointed toward me. You're ridiculous, I said.
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please join us at npr.org/booktour.
Every so often, don't you want to talk things over with somebody who's not just smart, but wise, to explore the deeper questions behind the headlines? That's what we do in our Wisdom Watch conversations. The current financial crisis gripping the country cries out for some common sense, so we decided to visit with Chris Gardner. Chris Gardner's life story is full of twists and turns. You know him from his autobiography, The Pursuit of Happiness, and the film of the same name, in which he was played by Will Smith. From a hard-knock childhood, he went on to battle homelessness while being a single dad. Without a college degree, he turned his sights on the finance industry, starting at the bottom, and he is now the owner and the CEO of his own brokerage firm, Gardner Rich, LLC. Chris Gardner is with us now in our Washington studio. Welcome. It's good to talk
to you. Thank you. Thank you.
So do you have any money left, I have to ask, after these tumultuous days? anything left in the portfolio?
Yeah. You know what? I took a position a little while ago that cash is king. And that meant that I maybe missed out on the run-up in real estate prices. I missed out on big runs up in the stock market. And cash is king.
I think a lot of people are wondering what exactly went wrong. What's your take?
Okay, it won't get talked about a lot, but hopefully this will be the last wake-up call for Wall Street. We've seen this movie before. Big Wall Street firms all go into one area because their competitors were in that area and making a ton of money. And if Company X is over here making all this money and we don't go, they'll have more capital than we have. They'll have market share. They'll have clients we don't have. So let's all go over here and do the same thing. That is exactly and precisely what happened. And if you look at history, you look at what happened in the junk bond market. Everybody ran over to this one particular area simply because money was being made. And I think they all acted like pigs. It's unfortunate that now we, taxpayers, American people, we're going to have to bail them out.
It's groupthink.
It's groupthink, and it's beyond groupthink. It's pigthink. It's all about money. And I got to tell you this, and I'll just be very, very honest with you. My old firm, Bear Stearns, man, it hurts me to my heart to see what's happened to that firm. That firm, it's been like watching the house you grew up in burn. And ain't nothing you can do about it. Now, folks talk about, well, Jimmy Kane lost $1 billion, and this guy lost several hundred million dollars. What about those people who worked at that company their whole lives, put that stock away, thinking they've got their retirement taken care of? Now, you're 55, 57 years old. That nest egg you thought you had put away is zero. And you've got to come out and find a job in an industry that is contracting, not expanding. We are about to see the creation of a whole new class of homeless people in America that I call white-collar homeless. Went to school, worked hard, played by the rules, and the world changed, and they're screwed.
For people who don't know the story, you know what you're talking about because you were homeless at a point in your life when you were trying to play by the rules, and working, and sort of things got away from you. A couple of things I wanted to talk about. For people who don't know the story, don't remember the story, you cut your teeth on the Dean Witter Reynolds training program. That firm no longer exists. You became a top earner at Bear Stearns and Company. That no longer exists. When you see that, how does that make you
feel? I'm telling you, again, like watching your house burn down. I had this thing I said many, many times. There are people at Bear Stearns I love like family. There were people at Bear Stearns I hate like family. Okay, but they were family just the same. I hear from somebody at Bear Stearns, formerly at Bear Stearns, every single day, and they're all saying the same thing. Can you help me find some work? Bright people, extremely talented, expertise, impeccable credentials. And there's no work for them.
Do you think that the lack of diversity in that industry is part of the reason that there is this groupthink mentality?
Lack of diversity, how so?
Demographic diversity.
No, no, yeah. It's got nothing to do with it, because black folks can be as big a pigs as anybody else. Okay, I mean, in the street, on the street, when it comes down to money, there's one color that's important on Wall Street, green.
What are the circumstances that allowed it to become as devastating as it has now become? Is it that because there was a lack of regulatory oversight? Is it the fact that people didn't understand the instruments that people were trading in so that people couldn't
follow
control it?
Follow the money. Just mm-hmm. follow the money. Money got created with the securitization of loans, car loans, home loans. And then we figured out, wait a minute, we can create a derivative product. But not only that, we can create a derivative of a derivative of a derivative. And if you just follow the money, that's all it was about. It's that simple.
Why weren't you tempted?
They're smarter than I am. And I'm like a lot of folks. I like to really understand the businesses that I invest in. For instance, if you're an investor and you want to be in the financial services business or you want to be exposed in banking, I think that a lot of your community-based banks are going to make some very, very attractive investment opportunities, because these guys minded their knitting, they stuck with businesses that they knew, and they didn't get involved in some of the more esoteric or exotic products that Wall Street was offering. And if you as an investor can look at a company and understand what they do, you got to be saying to yourself, well, I'm comfortable with that level of risk, so I'll invest here. So I think community-based banks could be very attractive investment opportunities going forward.
But your basic sort of word of wisdom here is that people should be investing in things that they understand that actually add value.
Invest your time before you invest your money. Always understand what it is that you're doing. And you know something else that's happening now, and this is going to be, it's kind of tricky, is, well, you get into people saying, well, I really didn't understand. Well, if you didn't understand, you should not have made the investment decision.
Does that also apply to these folks who have these subprime mortgages?
Absolutely.
Where the interest rates have gone through the
roof
and are now losing their homes?
Let me ask you a question. Whose responsibility is it? At some point, I mean, there is something called personal responsibility and accountability. And to be all of a sudden saying, oh, my God, I just didn't understand the terms. This is public radio. I can't say what I want to say. All right? You didn't understand the terms, but you signed the contract, so therefore I got to bail you out?
Well, there are advocacy groups that say that many of these firms used fraud to get people to sign these terms, and they didn't understand that they preyed on people who are naive and undereducated and presented them with information that simply wasn't true to induce them, particularly elderly people.
Fraud is fraud, and those people should be prosecuted. But there are indeed, again, some people who are saying, oh, I just didn't understand. Well, whose responsibility was it?
What's your take on the bailout proposal? Obviously, as you and I are speaking now, the proposal that was before the Congress was defeated by sort of a coalition of disgruntled people, mainly Republicans, but also some Democrats. What's your take on that?
You know what's kind of interesting is that a couple of things. Now, first of all, I haven't been as close to this whole thing as I would like to have been to really say something besides stuff that gets regurgitated on television and radio. But the first reaction is, whoa, maybe these people in Congress and the Senate, maybe they are indeed reacting to folks back home telling them no. Maybe some of the folks who said I can't support it are being responsive to their constituents who are saying no. That's number one. Number 1A, if I were in this position of trying to sell this bill, they're trying to sell it the wrong way. They've got it packaged. They've allowed it to get packaged as a bailout of Wall Street. If you're trying to sell this thing to regular folk, you got to make sure everybody understands what's in this for me. And I think a lot of people in America probably would be a little bit more comfortable with, well, what's in it for all of us, okay?
Well, you mentioned to me that you actually live on airplanes more than any one particular place. But if your member of Congress called you up and said, Chris, what should I do? What would you tell him?
Don't call me. You didn't call me before. And let's talk about all this great leadership we got going on. I mean, let's talk about this for a second. Okay, now everybody wants to exhibit their leadership abilities. Who was leading us before? My new book doesn't come out till next year. But one of the principles that I'm putting forth is, when this kind of environment, this kind of situation, how do we get here? Well, you know what? We drove here. Somebody was driving, and somebody is responsible. And it just kind of strikes me as funny that everyone wants to show their great leadership skills now. And well, how do we get here?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm speaking with Chris Gardner. He's the owner and CEO of Gardner Rich LLC. It's a brokerage firm. His autobiography is called The Pursuit of Happiness, and Will Smith played his character in the blockbuster film of the same name. You were telling us earlier that you think there's going to be a whole bunch of other people living the way you were at one point, which is really struggling to make ends meet.
They are right now.
Yeah. Maybe a strange question, but what advice do you have for people who find themselves perhaps unprepared to live a hard knock life? I bet you there are some people confronting financial problems now who never thought that they would be in that situation.
And those are the people that I was talking about when I referred to white-collar homeless. Those people, and especially, let's talk about the people in my business for a second on Wall Street. Too many times in my business, what you do becomes who you are. And when suddenly you don't do that anymore, well, who the hell are you? Those people who have their whole lives been about what they do and suddenly they don't do it anymore, that is devastating. But one thing that maybe some of those people will begin to do is try to take a serious look at, well, who am I really? And I'm not just Vinny that trades the 10-year on this desk here. I mean, previously, anybody who wanted to do something in size in the bond market had to call me. Well, guess what? They ain't got to call you anymore. So maybe it's time for you to reassess what else is it in you that makes you who you are and what makes you happy.
How did you keep it together on those months on the street?
I knew.
With your son with you. I mean, there are a lot of men who would have walked away from a situation.
But there are a lot
of men who have just, you know, dropped him off at a firehouse someplace and said, I can't do it.
I couldn't do that. I made a promise to myself at 5 years old. When I grow up, become a man, and have children, my children are going to know who their father is. Now, sometimes in your life, you get a chance to walk the walk. This was my opportunity. And as a little boy, to grow up without a father, now you read my book, you met my stepfather, I could have become my stepfather. I could have become another alcoholic, wife-beating, child-abusing, illiterate loser. And a lot of people would have said, well, look where he's from. Poor him. He didn't have a choice. I say BS. I did have a choice. I chose to embrace the light that I saw in my mom. And that's another concept that we've developed in the next book, which is this whole idea of spiritual genetics. I mean, we understand genetics. You're going to get your mom's eyes, your dad's nose. Ain't nothing you can do about it. But the spirit of who you're going to become as a person, as a man or a woman, I believe you can choose. And I chose to embrace the light. And you ask me, how did I keep going? To answer your question specifically, man, I saw my mama keep going every day. Mama used to say, boy, I've had to do so much with so little for so long, I can do anything with nothing.
Say that again, just hey, so I remember. Say that again.
I've had to do so much with so little for so long, I can do anything with nothing. And I saw her do it, Michelle. Okay, it wasn't just something catchy that she said. I saw her do it. And I'll never forget one day sitting with my mom watching a Western. And she would always get to the part of the movie where she knew, and she would say, the cavalry ain't coming. You think about that for a second. The cavalry ain't coming. Ain't no backup here.
Oh, dear.
And that's one of the things a lot of folk need to be thinking about right now today. Cavalry ain't coming, baby. It's you.
You think that the Congress should just skip this whole bailout thing and let these firms fail?
You know what? One of the basic principles of capitalism is the guys who manage their businesses well and sell products that people want do well. The guys who don't manage their businesses well fail. Let me ask you a question. And I know a lot of small business people out there got to be wondering or would say to themselves, man, I like a bailout. Who's going to bail me out? Let me see if I got this right. That's like saying, we tried capitalism, that didn't work, so now let's try socialism.
Well, but as I understand it, there was a point last week that there was zero lending going on pretty much anywhere in the Western Hemisphere.
And that is the only thing that makes me think that we must do something here. It's not to bail anybody out, but if we don't free up the credit markets, the people, regular folks with businesses, can get their business done. Now, let me ask you this. Now, you've been, you know, all over this thing. Let me see if I got this right. We're being asked to put up 100% of the money to bail everybody out, take 100% of the risk. What percentage of the reward are we going to get?
Well, in fact, that's one of the things that they're fighting over. Well, they're arguing over several things. Who's going to value the assets that the government buys, number one? And number two, what's the return for the taxpayer? But the shareholders are already wiped out from these firms.
Well, the shareholders are devastated, and that's why I have a difficult time with the concept of this word bailout. If you were one of the employees of many friends of mine who worked at Lehman Brothers, ain't nothing in you that feels like you have just been bailed out. Okay, you've been dumped on, you've been flushed, you ain't been bailed out.
One of the other things they're arguing about is whether there should be some more direct relief for homeowners, particularly people who bought into these subprime mortgages, and now the terms are such that they can't pay.
Let's talk about that for a second. Who? Not just everybody. The folks who overbought that house, the folks who maybe weren't as honest and direct as they should have been in buying these properties. No, they shouldn't get bailed out. But let's talk about...
But how would you know? Well, how would you know who's sort of worthy from who's not?
There's going to be... There should be a clear requirements. Have you lost a job as a result of indirectly some of these kinds of shenanigans that have been going on here? You come to the head of the line. Have you or your family member lost your health? Y'all come to the front of the line. The folks who were flipping properties and buying properties on spec, you go stand over there with them boys from Wall Street. We'll get to you.
Well, obviously, we have a lot to talk about. You've been generous with your time. But now, just wanted to know if you had a couple of words of wisdom for people as we go forward. But on a number of levels. One, as a family man, trying to kind of maintain your family and keep your family together when you're facing these difficult times, there are a lot of people for whom this is a real challenge to self. So do you have some words of wisdom for people who are in that situation? And secondly, I don't know, just overall.
Well, family first. And what you have in the bank, it's got absolutely nothing to do with the quality of life in your home. It shouldn't. And if that's been the case, then maybe you need to reassess that whole situation. But family first. And honestly, I don't think you can be counting on the government to come and take care of you. It's going to come down to friends, family, and just some folks. It ain't going to be the feds. There are folks still down in New Orleans waiting on the feds to come and get them. Ain't going to happen. Okay? I would say continue to believe in yourself, trust your friends, but have faith in God.
Chris Gardner. He's the owner and CEO of Gardner Rich, LLC. His autobiography is called The Pursuit of Happiness. Will Smith played his character in the blockbuster film. He was with us here in our Washington, D.C. studios, and he informs us he's got a book coming out next year, and we'll look forward to that. Maybe you'll come back and see us.
I will look forward to that.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.